All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Compliance Guy podcast. My name is Sean Weiss. As always, I want to say thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to tune in and listen to what I have on my head each week. Sometimes I have more than one thing going on in my head. But this week, I thought that I would stray off the path of regulatory compliance. Now, I know some of you are going, wait, what? I thought you're the compliance guy. Well, I am. But for the first 5 years of my professional career, I actually worked in operations. I worked in practice management, practice administration. And I thought maybe it would be wise to embark down that path for today. Because I know there's a lot of people who listen to my podcasts who are not regulatory officers. They're not lawyers. They're not auditors and coders or billers. They're leaders of healthcare organizations. These are practice managers, practice administrators, COOs, CFOs. Sometimes I get the occasional CEO who was looking for something else and stumbled upon me, and for whatever reason, they just couldn't change the channel. So I thought that it would be a good idea to dust off some of the old conversations that I've had in the early part of my career and focus a little bit today on the organization and management. Creating policies tied to personnel as opposed to regulatory compliance. Focusing on managed care, time management, financial methods, billing system controls, and really the revenue cycle management. I mean, these are things that we were doing before revenue cycle management became the big sexy term. But I think one of those things that I want to talk about is what makes an effective leader. Because I think we can all agree, in modern business, there's an emphasis on metrics and on KPIs and ROI. And the concept of a good leader poses something of a paradox. I mean, listen, there's no true measure of good leadership. There's no line item on a P&L labeled net leadership. I mean, there's a lot of studies out there, right? And these studies, you know, some of them have shown that, you know, strong leadership is not only one of the best recipes for survival and success in the business world, but that it's actually a key part of effectively navigating the world of small business. And we work in an industry where a lot of folks matriculate. You know, they start off answering the phone and they do a great job and they matriculate into the billing role. And then they do a great job there and they matriculate into a compliance role. And then they do really good there and they matriculate into a leadership role as the practice administrator or practice manager. But the problem is, in a lot of these cases, folks are just thrown into or hoisted into a situation without getting the fundamental training that's needed to help them become a better leader, to help them learn how to lead, not just manage, but to actually lead. Leadership is the interaction between leaders and followers, and how one achieves direction, alignment, and commitment in the other. You can take it a step further and say that leadership is where you're creating an environment where your people go beyond the norm and do more than even they would have expected they could do. Because leaders make others feel like they are more, so they want to do more. And when I get into a lot of these conversations with some of the management consultants I get to work with, and some of the practice managers I engage with on a daily basis, you know, I always ask them, do you think you were born to lead? Or do you think leadership's an art? Because if you're not born with it, can you learn it? Can you manage and never truly be a leader? Can hard work and practice make you a leader? What about this statement? Leadership is a trait that is innate, and thus, it can't be learned. Well, obviously, working in healthcare, we're surrounded by scientists. So what does science say about this? Well, researchers at a leading institute indicate that 30 to 35% of leadership is actually genetic. But they indicate that much more leadership ability is clearly attributable to things like education, life events, and what some may call trigger moments. I would agree with that. But as I said before, ask yourself the question, are you managing and not leading? Now, some may be sitting there thinking to themselves, well, what the heck is the difference between managing and leading? Well, the U.S. military gives a very simple answer. They say that people are led and things are managed. See, I agree with that. But if you really want to break them down, let's break them down to the basics. Because managing is looking retrospectively, backward, being reactive, where leadership is forward-looking. It's seeing what comes next. One of my favorite quotes is by Stanley C. Allen. And it goes something like this. Leadership involves remembering past mistakes, an analysis of today's achievements, and a well-grounded imagination in visualizing the problem of the future. Well, healthcare continuously goes through these evolutions. Times have changed, times are continuing to change, and times will obviously change in the future, right? We came from usual customary and reasonable reimbursement to a discount fee for service. We moved into capitation. We got out of capitation. Now it seems that we're headed back towards capitation. But what about the cost of running a medical practice? I mean, those have definitely outpaced reimbursement rates. I think everybody listening to this podcast would agree with that. The continuous barrage of Medicare and Medicaid regulations. It's almost unimaginable. The level of accountability that people were being held to with respect to compliance from OIG, HIPAA, OSHA. To be a successful leader, ask yourself, what skills will you need in the future to be able to succeed? See, for me, I think there's four competencies that are recognized. Three of them are learned, one is innate, right? So the three learned are clinical, financial, and marketing. Because we can learn how to market. We can learn how to strategize. We can learn basic principles of finance and accounting. We can learn how to be a clinician. But the innate aspect is that psychological makeup. So for me, those are what I would consider the four competencies that should be focused on for any practice leader. And that brings us to a question, right? So we talked about managing versus leading. But we have titles in practices like the practice manager. Well, who is the manager? Well, to me, they're an implementer of policies and plans. But more importantly, their personality needs to work with that of the physician owner or owners. And we need to ensure that this individual is set up for success. The practice manager, the administrator of an organization, should not be treated in the same manner as other employees. And one of the ways that we differentiate a manager in a practice is through an employment agreement. Could their benefits differ from what the practice policy is for the rest of the staff? Certainly. Can we delineate what their responsibilities are? Can we define a clear scope of authority? Are we able to create a clear chain of command? Absolutely. And that's how we convey who the manager is and who the leader is of our staff. But it's the manager's job to motivate the staff and get them on board. Because leadership is an observable, learnable set of practices. So we can learn to lead and be seen as leaders by our staff. For me, leaders get things done by teaching, coaching, manipulating, and consulting people that have a sense of purpose and belonging within the practice. So the question becomes, what kind of leader are you? Are you a drill sergeant, meaning that you're task-focused? Are you a coach, meaning that you're more goal-focused? Are you the negotiator, meaning that you're group-focused? Or are you an innovator, meaning that you're an idea-focused individual? I don't know. I kind of like to look at myself back in the old days as sort of a mashup of all four. I was task-focused, goal-oriented, group-focused, and idea-focused. So I was a drill sergeant, a coach, a negotiator, and an innovator. And I think that's what a lot of folks have gotten away from. And they have tried to hone their skills on being one type of leader and really putting themselves into a vacuum. So let's talk a little about these different types of leaders. We can start with the drill sergeant, as I like to refer to him. As I said, this is an individual who is task-focused. So what does that mean? Well, they act decisively. They are results-oriented. They value consistency and past experience, and they show determination. These are individuals who value action above wisdom. But they can show impatience, and they can be abrupt, and sometimes, unfortunately, even rude. There's no doubt they can be stubborn and unwilling to adapt. And a lot of times, we have found these type of task-focused individuals don't listen to their subordinates. And that's a problem. So if you're a coach, what does that mean? Typically, you act logically and methodically. You're a team-oriented, collaborating kind of person. You value teaching and delegating tasks. and you appreciate displays of long-term commitment from your staff. These individuals tend to employ a hierarchical and controlling attitude. Individual performance can go unrecognized. Sometimes they dump too much responsibility too early on individuals. And sometimes they can set unrealistic, overly ambitious goals. So that takes us to our negotiator. Somebody who acts cautiously, who avoids unnecessary risks. They're quite charming. They're people-oriented. They embrace change and creative input. They show an openness and a willingness to listen. But sometimes they miss opportunities by waiting. And a lot of times they want to be liked more than they want to lead. And as a result, that turns to a lack of structure and organizational skills. And for me, these negotiators tend to suffer from paralysis by analysis. And the last of our four, the idea-focused innovator. Somebody who acts intuitively. They're vision-oriented. They value enthusiasm and big ideas, and they display charisma. Very personable, but they can be impetuous and take unnecessary risks. Sometimes they lack follow through because they get easily distracted. And they can overlook key details and be too optimistic. But really, they rely solely on charm as well as a way to motivate. So for me, I think you have to believe in yourself first. Then get others to believe in themselves by excelling under your direction. You need to search for opportunities and take risks. Inspire your staff with a vision of what the future holds. But most importantly, behave consistently and with purpose, and recognize contributions and accomplishments. As a leader, give your staff clear understanding of their job responsibilities and what the boundaries are. Break your routine to address a great opportunity. Make decisions, but be flexible, be sharp, but hone your skills. Manage by making changes without blaming. But most importantly, understand your employee's strengths and weaknesses and don't let them fail. Because a fear of failing can cause excessive stress and errors and poor decision making. Now, we find this more common with new managers and those who have been tagged with a lot of new responsibilities. And keep in mind, no person is immune. Lord knows I made a lot of mistakes throughout the first 5 years, 6 years of my professional career. I still make mistakes. I try to minimize them, and I try to recognize them as soon as they're made. But you have to look for signs. And then you have to intervene with support, training, and guidance, so that the same mistake or mistakes don't continue to resurface. Remember, management is doing through others. So effective delegation is the key to allowing managers the time to focus on the larger picture and managing resources. You as the manager, as the practice leader, you cannot be the bottleneck. So, when you're dealing with your employees who are taking on new responsibilities, explain it in a positive light to ensure that you get the initial buy-in that you need. Make sure you detail the skills, the time, the training, and performance standards, and how they relate to current responsibilities and future goals. Solicit feedback and then get an agreement on any revisions or changes to your scope of their responsibilities. But you got to make it clear that help is always available. And then get commitment and a completion date for these individuals taking on these new tasks, these new responsibilities. And don't be afraid to express confidence and then follow through on your promises of training and education and feedback. And remember, document any new responsibilities assigned to your staff in their personnel file and keep track of deadlines. Remember, empowerment results from effective delegation. When delegation is passing the buck or seen as delegation of tasks only, it can be an absolute demotivator. Motivation, without a doubt, takes encouragement. Don't be afraid as a leader to step out on that ledge. Money isn't always the best motivator for your staff. Keep track of what you feel motivates your staff. Is it gas cards, you know, to Shell or Exxon or 76 or QP or whatever the gas stations are by you? Is it a gift card to Sam's or Walmart or Target or to a food store like Publix or Kroger or Vons or Albertsons? Money isn't always a motivator. You have to determine your employees' needs. And then you as the leader have to determine the resources that are available. And you do this to be able to determine the right person for the job. Switching gears, time management has always been and continues to be a big problem for a lot of managers. And that's why I like task lists. But the problem with task lists is that they sometimes become unrealistic and they become unmanageable. And as a result, we haven't accomplished the 25 things that we put onto our list today. And then we get demotivated, which is why you need to be realistic. For me, I put 5 things on my task list every single day. And if I don't get to all 5, then I take those that were left over from today and I move them to tomorrow and I prioritize them in order of importance in my mind. So I use my task list daily. I use them weekly. I use them monthly. And another area that I think practice managers struggle with are staff interviews. I think soliciting feedback from your staff, especially when you're asking for open and honest feedback, I think it's a great thing. But sometimes love stings. So remember, solicit candid feedback on what is and isn't working and what ideas your staff have for improving the practice. Because the best recommendations and a way to improve staff morale is to listen to what they're telling you and to act on those items that are reasonable and that you know aren't going to disrupt the overall mechanism that makes your machine run. As I said, use the feedback and your task lists as the basis for restructuring responsibilities and job descriptions when things don't appear to be working the way that they need to. One of the things I've always talked about is reasons for employee dissatisfaction and turnover. Believe it or not, communication is number 7. Lack of motivation, lack of understanding of the job, personality conflicts, lack of mutual respect. Those are the first 4 reasons that rank the highest for employee dissatisfaction and turnover. And when it comes to termination, good Lord, don't beat around the bush. I know it's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. And that's why you're in the role of being a leader. Make it quick, and it will definitely be less painful. Use the Band-Aid approach. This is why I tell practice managers and physician leaders, you cannot become friends with your staff. You can't. Because when things go wrong, and they will, because we're all human, it becomes awkward. It becomes painful. We worry about somebody bringing up something that happened at dinner last week, or, you know, when we were all together at somebody's house for Scrabble or Jenga or whatever games people play today. There's a difference between being friendly and being friends. I don't come to work to be anybody's friend. I come to work because I'm paid to do a job. So when it comes to termination, you got to be prepared. Have your statement of termination ready. Have a check with their final pay, including any unused pay days off. If it's appropriate, you can have a letter of reference. But make sure you also have what I call a silent witness, somebody who just sits there, observes, doesn't say a word, and we're able to document everything in the event somebody contests what took place during that termination. And when it comes to practice policies and employment agreements, just like I talk about in the world of compliance, make them written. Word of mouth means absolutely nothing. If you're going to obtain an employee acknowledgement that they will abide by policies, get them to sign an attestation or a pledge. Make sure that you clearly state that the policies are not a contract and are subject to change at the discretion of management. And the reason why I like employment contracts is because it allows some deviation from the actual policies, so we're not literally pigeonholed into it. And as I said, don't try to recreate the wheel. Have policies that reduce risk of noncompliance with federal, state, and local laws and regulations. Drug testing, HIV, discrimination, contractor status, summary dismissals, grievance procedures, sexual harassment, FLSA, FMLA, OSHA, Civil Rights Act, ADA, HIPAA. If you're not sure what policies you need to have, ask. But as a physician leader and or a manager of a practice, ask yourself, do you have a clear goal? And have you communicated these to your staff? Do you personally know what your role is as the manager or the physician leader? And are you willing to pay the price for success? Because clarity of purpose at all levels creates synergy within a medical practice. And synergy is defined as the sum of all parts being greater than the contribution of an individual effort. Which takes me right into strategic goals and developing a strategic plan. We need to have an assessment. We need to have goals, objectives. We need to be able to act on those, and we have to be able to monitor those. That's how we manage expectations. When we're setting goals and objectives, begin with an assessment of your organization and all of its parts. Define where you and the practice want to be in 3 months, 6 months. Do you have a 1 year, a 3 year, a 5 year, or a 10 year plan? And when you set objectives, make sure you do it for specific time periods. But most importantly, make them measurable. So when you get into the assessment aspect, right? Now we're talking about a SWOT analysis. And I talked about doing a SWOT analysis with Ken Hertz, one of my buddies and such a great practice management expert. Focus on the opportunities in the industry and the local market, and focus on the threats from outside sources. Then you could go back and focus on the internals. What are your strengths and weaknesses? But you got to focus on the physician's role in management because they play a significant role. One of the things I always give as an option for clients is, you know, you can have an external analysis of your marketing, financial, operational, and organizational situations. There's great people out there who can do this. You're not having to go it alone. So let me kind of sum up what we've talked about thus far, right? I think first and foremost is that a strategy is a path to obtaining a goal. And a strategic plan is synonymous with a business plan, right? Because a business plan identifies how the practice will use its resources to achieve objectives. A manager manages resources. And for a manager, people are the most valuable resource because people follow the leader, and an effective leader will help the practice achieve its goals. So it becomes critical to understand who and what we are working for. Remember, the organization and management of the practice serve the owners. So for us, we need to leverage the physician's time. And the level of buy-in from the physicians and their motivations will determine the outcome of any strategic initiative. As I tell my clients all the time, don't sacrifice what you want most for what you're willing to accept now. And that helps us to avoid some common pitfalls, right? Because as we all know, change makes planning difficult. Because change, no matter how positive it is, it's always going to generate resistance. And medical practices, small, medium, large practices, often feel planning isn't necessary. And the reason why is because planning tends to fall apart. But do you know why it falls apart? It falls apart because of inadequate monitoring by leadership. Leadership has limited ability, initiative, or authority. And there's a lack of commitment or support from leadership. Again, as I said, define your goals. Then objectives that can be measured. Remember, change has to occur after defined objectives are in place. And then we have to monitor the effectiveness of change against the objectives. But at the end of the day, None of this will work without physician buy-in. Now, I've been a part of a lot of planning sessions. I've seen some good ones, and I've also seen some bad ones. And I think there's a few things that you guys can do to ensure success. And they're simple. There are things like defining your mission statement and your philosophy. Defining your goals for a year, for 3 years, and 5 years. But it's also a good thing to define your short-term goals, as we talked about before, your 3, 6, and 9 months. Define specific objectives for the practice. And agree and appear as one. Listen, you have to know where you are to get to where you want to be. Listen, I might not always agree with my partners at our firm, and I can tell you they don't always agree with me. But at the end of a board meeting, at the end of a discussion between the partners, we are aligned because we do what's best for the organization as opposed to any one individual. Don't be afraid to perform your SWOT analysis, your strengths, your weaknesses. Remember those internal, and then your external, your opportunities and threats. That's where, again, my good friend Ken Hertz says, start with the opportunities and threats. Because those are the outside things. The internal things, obviously, we know we can control a little bit better, like our strengths and weaknesses. Make sure you're getting objective data and information from advisors and from, you know, trusted management sources. And don't be afraid to brainstorm. Save the criticisms for the politicians. They seem to have that down pretty well. Make sure you understand your service mix, understand your fees and how things are structured. But most importantly, know the cost of doing business. And you do this to determine the demand of your target market. Ask your patients. Look at competitors. Read. Determine what services you can and will provide. Make sure you understand what equipment is needed, what your break-even analysis tells you, what type of training is required. Does your facility have the capacity to take on new service mixes? But most importantly, determine the most effective use of the provider's time. Understand what your reimbursement rates are per hour. Just taking these little steps are sure ways to tighten up your operations. If you're creating a business plan, know the purpose of the plan. Make sure you gather proper data to implement the plan. Get your physicians buy-in before you change any formulas to compensation or any structural changes in the workforce that you're planning to make. And be willing to make modifications and deal with provider pushback. Listen, we've talked about it in the beginning. Times continue to change. Health reform, Medicare, Medicaid, private and commercial payers, regulatory and legislative changes, accountability with OIG, OSHA, and HIPAA, expenses and revenues not in sync. What skills do we need to succeed in the future? I mean, these are all things that have to be thought of. Do you have a goal? Do you know your role? Are you willing to pay the toll? Remember, a clarity of purpose at all levels creates synergy within a medical practice. All right. The last thing that I want to talk about on today's podcast is really simple, and that's adding ancillary services and other moneymakers to the practice. Again, if you tune in to my podcasts with Jordan Johnson and Eric Rubenstein, Coffee Compliance and Chuckleheads, you know, we talk a lot about these schemes and these innovations that are brought to practices by vendors all the time. And we talk about the pitfalls and we talk about how to navigate these murky waters. But if you're looking to add ancillary services to the mix, consider expanding your diagnostics based on your specialty. Adding non-physician practitioners to aid in screening and routine follow-up services, those less high-priced reimbursable services. Expand your services to meet demands of your targeted patients and or of employers in the local market. Remember, small business owners who cannot afford to offer insurance coverage to their employees, you know, are seeking alternatives. Integrating with other practices that complement your practice. Look to possibly create a multidiscipline entity. Look at your local ACOs. And then figure out how to gain efficiencies in how you run your practice. There's so much that we could continue to talk about, but obviously, with these podcasts, I try to keep them to 30 to 45 minutes. So I think we'll, for today, go ahead and pause here. And maybe somewhere down the road on another podcast, we'll be able to get into more of a discussion about setting fee schedules and compensation plans and tying that back maybe into the business of medicine as well. So again, thank you so much for taking time out of what I know is always a busy day for you, the healthcare professional, to tune in and listen to my podcasts. Again, this is the Compliance Guy podcast. My name is Sean Weiss, but today we took a right at Albuquerque instead of a left to explore the best of the best and what managers do that sustains success. Thanks for joining. See you again real soon.